From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Last night here in St. Louis before heading back to Los Angeles. Later on tonight, those open lines. Here's what's happening. Well, folks, first of all, the madness has got to stop. We'll get into this in a second. An arsenal of weapons, including bomb-making material, found in the home of that sniper who killed five Dallas police officers, wounding six others, telling police during the entire episode he wanted to kill white people. During a search of Micah Xavier Johnson's home, detectives found bomb-making materials, ballistic vests, rifles, ammunition, and a personal journal of combat tactics as well. The Dallas mayor, Mike Rawlings, later told an afternoon news conference that he believed Johnson was the lone shooter, a mobile shooter with written manifestos about how to shoot and move on. He is believed to be from the Dallas suburb of Mesquite. Confirmed that his racial rage to police as he was holed up in the El Centro College parking garage in downtown Dallas. He is dead, obviously, when a robotic system that police sent in there blew him up. Police officers have saying right now that there are targets in Tennessee, Georgia, and Missouri in the aftermath of two high-profile killings of black men by law enforcement as well. In Baldwin, Missouri, a suburb of St. Louis, folks, not far from where I am, a police officer tonight is in critical condition after he was shot in the neck during a traffic stop this morning. The police chief out there says, make no mistake about it, we believe this was an ambush. Again, another individual just upset with what is going on. The suspect is 31 years old. He had many prior criminal history situations. A black Army veteran accused of shooting indiscriminately at passing cars and police on a Tennessee highway told investigators he was troubled by police violence against African Americans as well. Folks, we got to calm down here in this country before this gets out of hand. Let law enforcement and the law take care of what needs to be taken care of. If there are police officers who are acting indiscriminately, who are going beyond the call of duty for what they're supposed to do, let the law take care of it. Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. John was with us through most of the night last night during the tense and horrible situation in Dallas. John, I wanted to get your reflection on today now that we've got a better picture of what happened in Dallas and what's going on around the country.
Well, there's going to be a lot of copycat kind of episodes that are going on now. I think it's a accumulation, volcanic kind of buildup that has just erupted, essentially. And it's not helped at all by G.K. Butterfield, you know, the chairman of the Black Caucus in Congress, essentially saying that the Second Amendment, we have to either use this, you know, these incidents, as a means of kind of extracting, exacting, whatever, gun control legislation, or there's going to be, and this is his quote, a long, hot summer. Now, what is a member of Congress threatening, basically, essentially turning loose a restive population that is not happy and disgruntled, but inciting more violence? That is outrageous that a member of Congress would do that. I don't think it's helpful either for President Obama to speak out and say how poor the U.S. criminal justice system is, essentially saying it's a de facto, it's a two-part system, one for blacks and one for whites. Here's what I think goes on with the police. I think 99.9% of police officers are well-trained and good. I think there's a very small fraction who slip through the interview process. They somehow bluff their way through their psych evaluations that they all have to take, and they are not suitable to be in panic-related situations. They panic easily. This is not simply a racism issue. This is an issue of police who are not fit for duty because of stress, because of any other reason. They get into a panic situation, and they're trigger happy, and they pull the trigger. that's what usually goes on with these officer-related killings once you really do the post-mortem autopsy on this. The African-American community is inferring from this some kind of institutional racism that is across the board, across the United States. That is blatantly not the case in 99.9% of these cases. What happened in Dallas was obviously a totally deranged individual, no different really from a terrorist.
Yeah, he flipped out. His friends say he came back from Afghanistan changed.
Well, and that is something that nobody really is pointing the finger at, that he's probably got a severe case, probably had a severe case of post-traumatic stress, and all of these incidents are whipped into a frenzy on 24/7 cable news. And as I mentioned last night, I have never seen a bigger change of heart from the cable news two nights ago when they were ranting and raving about this egregious police abuse that was going on. And then the day after the massacre takes place, they're sympathetic to the police. I think the cable news have to be more responsible in presenting an even-handed analysis of what goes on in officer-related shootings. This is not, as I said, a widespread a kind of institutional racism in police departments around the country. It's a case of a handful of police officers that are not fit for duty. And I think that was clearly the case in the Michael Brown incident in Ferguson, where it was obvious that that guy was not fit for duty. And I think you'll find that in most of these cases, these officers panic and they get become trigger happy.
Well, but I got to tell you, John, I was out here in Ferguson during that event. And, you know, the individual, Michael Brown, sadly did go for the police officer's gun. That's a no-no.
Oh, of course. But what I'm saying is that the vigilante mentality of certain police officers, they're trained to get backup. Nobody who steals some cigarillos out of a convenience store, the outcome of this should not be a death of any individual.
No. I mean, everybody was wrong.
But again, I think it's very important for the public to understand that instead of attributing this to institutional racism across the country and police departments, they should understand that these police are all too human and subject to the same kind of vulnerability. Unfortunately, not all of them should be involved in these officer-related shootings.
All right, my friend. And John, thank you again for everything you did for us last night and that you continue to do for us on the show. Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. And, of course, the episode in Minnesota where the African-American was killed in his car with his girlfriend sitting next to him and a baby in the back, and she streamed it live on the Internet. Lauren Weinstein with us, the expert on the Internet. That was an amazing piece, I got to tell you, of technology, Lauren.
Yeah, I think that events of the last couple of days here, what you were just speaking of, and also the horrific events last night were also being live streamed from at least two sources that we know of right now, have brought this technology to what we would call an inflection point. I mean, up to now, it's been kind of fun. People have done jokey things on it and have had done birthday parties. We were starting to already see some shadows of some pretty bad things that we've talked about in the past.
That's right.
At least one rape that was live streamed. There was a suicide that was live streamed. And now I think we've reached the point where we see that the impact of this technology of live streaming, whether it's from Facebook, Google has something similar, there will be many more types of systems like this, is going to have a tremendous impact on society. And we're going to have to start figuring out how we're going to deal with it. Because
you're right.
My view on these is that you really want us, the users, and the companies to figure this out. You know, how are we going to decide what's appropriate, what's not appropriate? How are we going to age limit? How are we going to decide when something is just absolutely egregious? Because on the other hand, this technology can be incredibly valuable in terms of letting us see what's actually going on in the world. The probative value can be incredible. It can be incredibly important for our democracy. On the other hand, you don't want to encourage you know, horrific monsters in search of an audience to do terrible things, to know that they can live stream it, perhaps even live streaming it themselves. And if we don't get a handle on this ourselves, if we don't find a way to manage this technology, we can assume that governments around the world are going to move in, and they're going to use it as an excuse for very broad censorship. That's always what happens. You get a knee-jerk reaction.
Well, I understand.
And I had thought we were going to have a little bit more time to work on this, but I think after what we've seen the last 48, 72 hours or so, this has to be moved up to a priority issue. I wrote about this on my blog today, if anyone wants to read a little more of the details on this. And they can find that via Vortex, VORTEX.com. But really, I'd be interested in what viewers feel about, you know, what listeners feel about this, because this is so complicated, and it's going to be so important that we have to start planning out the policy now before it just spins completely out of control. Because it doesn't take very many events like this to cause governments to react in ways that we generally find are counterproductive in the long run.
Lauren, this is worth a couple hours for a show, so check in, of course, with Tom and Lisa, and let's set up a schedule to do that, because this is a critically important subject. One quick question about it. How do people find the live stream? Is this something where she, for example, in Minnesota, sent it to her friends on Facebook, and then they sent it to friends? How does it grow so fast?
Yeah, there seems to be a whole ecosystem forming around publicizing these streams. In a lot of cases, that's what happens right now. Someone will send it to their immediate followers. They will send it to their followers or post it in places where it has broader visibility. And it's amazing how quickly that, you know, you get exponential growth. And these systems have been built to handle a lot of viewers. And what happens is this all occurs so quickly that even if a firm has a policy in place, for example, you know, if there's something horribly graphic and you know, just bizarre and awful taking place, by the time they learn about it, it's already out there.
Yes.
And there's no way to run it, to rewind it back and stop it. There probably are ways to deal with this through organized crowdsourcing, but we really are just at this is such so early in the technology, and it has become so powerful so fast that I don't think anybody, including the firms that have built these systems, were really prepared for this to happen this way.
All right, Lauren, thank you so much. And definitely, let's do a program on this. I mean, the capabilities now of streaming live and sending it worldwide instantly on events that happen all over the place is truly remarkable. It really is with this technology. Imagine a planet with triple sunrises and sunsets every day for part of the year and then nonstop daylight at other times. Astronomers have revealed such a place in a strange new world in a constellation, Centaurus, that has not one, not two, but three suns. And what's more, a year there lasts half a millennium from Earth's perspective. Amazing. In a moment, Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center gives us his weekly update on just what's going on in the skies. And then Joshua P. Warren joins us with an incredible story of a possible ET contact. Next. And we're going to take our minds off some of the tragedies that have been occurring around this planet. You cannot forget it, and we never will. But tonight, now that we've got most of the news out of the way, let's go first to Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center for his weekly update. Quite a week, Peter, but go ahead and enlighten us with some UFO stories.
Well, it is quite a week, George, and I'm saddened by the events across this country. I agree with your assessment. Everybody has to discipline himself or herself, and we've got to rein in this violence and sort of reassess things and go at it from a different vantage point. But on the subject of UFOs, you're right, there's a lot been going on, and you may recall, I'm sure you recall, last week I made an appeal to the Coast audience that if they were going to be attending fireworks displays, to keep their eyes open, take a camera with them, and report anything really unusual that they saw that clearly was not fireworks related. And a lot of the Coast audience did that. We just updated our website thanks to a gargantuan effort on behalf of our webmaster, Christian, and just posted about 300 new reports collected over the last couple of weeks. About 64 of those, I think it is, were from the 4th of July, Monday of this week. Really interesting events that we have seen reported on the 4th of July in the past. In fact, if people would like to test my statement, test my theory about the 4th of July and how many reports of interesting reports we get on that date, I would encourage them to go to the 4th of July for 1997, 19 years ago. Very, very unusual event that was widely reported and widely investigated by David Marler, a former Coast guest, and a lot of other UFO investigators in the St. Louis and Illinois area. Again, the 4th of July, 1997, first reported by an air traffic controller in Paducah, Illinois. Looking north, he saw an object come down vertically, and it suddenly just bent to the west, turned to the west, and hundreds of reports from all over Illinois and St. Louis.
Including police officers.
Pardon?
Including police officers.
Absolutely. Reporting. And had you been looking out a window to the north from where you are now at that 19 years ago, you would have seen that object, George. But just briefly, going back to Friday of last week, the 1st of July, 1:30 in the morning, two adult workers were standing outside, and they were quite surprised to see a very large green object come streaking down out of the sky. Under ordinary circumstances, I would assume that an event like that could be ascribed to just a pedestrian meteoritic event, a meteor coming in from space. But this green object happened to have stopped. It jumped across the sky a short distance and then streaked off. The witnesses report that they saw it for about 7 seconds or so. I mention it because an hour and a half later, very interesting event occurred over White Center, Washington, very well-known area, just east of Seattle and just south of Bellevue. Four adults standing outside, and they heard one of these mysterious sounds, George, a screeching sound.
Uh-huh.
They equate it to a car accelerating and burning its tires. It even made animals very uncomfortable, they report. Very interesting event, and I mentioned that one because about 6 hours later, a similar report from Escondido, California. Unfortunately, the individual who submitted that report chose to remain anonymous. We are unable to get in touch with him, would like to hear from him again so we can get a little more data. Shifting to the 4th of July, Monday of this week, very interesting sighting in Orlando, Florida. And just to prove that all of these sightings on the 4th of July are not during fireworks, this one occurred at about 3 p.m. East Coast time, again over Orlando, Florida. Gentleman resting in his swimming pool saw a very, very bright and seemingly large, that is bigger than an airliner at cruise altitude, object, very bright. It came in from the east, perpendicular to a contrail that he had been watching, and the object suddenly stopped, changed direction, and went streaking off so fast that it just disappeared from his sight instantly. And finally, last report from Elk Grove, California, again, the 4th of July, 9 p.m., I invite the Coast listeners, anybody who's interested, to read this report. Gentlemen saw a very interesting, initially a white object, a white light, come in at very high speed, very high altitude, he thought, although altitude's very difficult to know. And it, like many of the reports posted for the 4th of July, did some sudden turns, 90-degree turns, acceleration, stopped, and then disappeared in the night sky. So it's been a very, very active week. And again, I encourage the Coast listeners who might be interested to visit our website and read some of those reports for the 4th of July.
And that website is ufocenter.com, right?
Yes, correct.
You got it. Thank you, Peter. We'll talk to you next week. Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center, where he puts together weekly reports on episodes that come in from really all over the planet, straight into the National UFO Reporting Center. I shall tell you that Peter does all this out of his own pocketbook. If you want to make a donation of a dollar or two, Let me give you an address. It's the National UFO Reporting Center, P.O. Box 700, Davenport, Washington, 99122. You got that? Help him out a little bit. We always do. Up next, Joshua P. Warren joins us with some incredible stories. He's next. Hey, when you get a moment, get up to our website, coasttocoastam.com, and take a look at some of the images that Joshua P. Warren has sent us that'll go along with his interview tonight on Coast to Coast, because we're going to be talking about some incredible things that he has been working on, and just sit there at the edge of your seat. And welcome back to Coast, Joshua P. Warren with us. He, of course, is a paranormal investigator. He is based out of Asheville, North Carolina and Puerto Rico. It is going to be my pleasure to have him as one of our guests at our live event in Asheville on Saturday, August 27th in Asheville. I am looking forward to this event, Josh.
Oh, I am too, George. And, you know, it would be fun enough just to come and watch you and me and Micah Hanks and Bill Forsten all talking about things. But as you and Tom have mentioned on this show, we have a very special little surprise. I have some actual debris that was recovered from near the Roswell crash site, and we have made arrangements for that debris to be put on display under armed guard. And at the end of the event, we are actually going to allow every single person in attendance to stop by and actually touch this debris and have a photograph made with it. So probably a once-in-a-lifetime experience, and I hope that everybody will show up and come do this, but I think that you're selling out pretty quickly.
I'm going to run off with the debris and steal it, Josh.
We've got to keep an eye out for that.
With the guards chasing me.
Well, you know, it might fly off on its own. And, in fact, one of the weird things about this debris, and we're going to show footage of this during the program there. When I first got this stuff, was experimenting with it along with my team. And one of the things we did was take a piece of it and put it in an electrostatic field. Now, one of these pieces, it just looks like a little sliver. And as soon as we put it in the field, the thing stood up vertically and began to spin with incredible speed. I mean, it was mind-boggling, and you're going to get to see that. So obviously, there's something about this particular material that reacts very dynamically when put into an electrostatic field.
Josh, you've got some images that we have up there at coasttocoastam.com, which are pretty remarkable. You've kind of taken a move into the ET arena. Tell me what you're working on.
Well, you know, of course, I'm joining you tonight from the Bermuda Triangle Research Base here in Puerto Rico. And I have got so much stuff to tell you. I've literally divided it into three chapters. But I promise I will keep each chapter as short as possible.
That's right.
And it's great, you know, tying into what I was just saying about what we're going to have at the event. Well, to start with, I am currently working on setting up history's very first free live stream of a UFO hotspot in the Bermuda Triangle. Now, I know you were just talking about the ease with which people are streaming these days, but it's still a lot more complicated when you're trying to set up a stream that runs practically 24 hours a day and archives the footage for analysis afterward. And so I'm hoping that all the listeners will help me, once this is up and running, go through on perhaps a daily basis and analyze this footage. And so I hope to have that up and running within the next week or two. Anybody can go to my website and just subscribe to my free e-newsletter to be alerted when this link is up and running and when you can start seeing this stuff. Well, I of course, have done a lot of research here to figure out the best place to put this webcam. And there are lots of possibilities because, obviously, this is a hot spot in general for strange activity. Well, I want to tell you first off about a place that I discovered, and it ties into the images there at coasttocoastam.com. I had heard that there was some ancient ruins nearby, about an hour down the road, so to speak, from where I am right now. It turns out that 41 years ago, in 1975, some ruins were discovered,
and they have now been partially excavated, which are being described by archaeologists and anthropologists as literally the oldest astronomical observatory in the entire area, in the Bermuda Triangle, specifically in the Antilles, which includes all the big islands here, like Cuba, Haiti, Jamaica, Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico. This is the oldest astronomical observatory. And in fact, the way this was discovered is a really interesting story. It's in Ponce, Puerto Rico, and locals there told me that there was a resident who lived in a house right next to this thickly wooded area, and that for years he was hearing ghostly voices in the woods and telling people for the longest time, these woods are haunted, they're speaking some language I can't explain, I don't understand it. And then finally there in 1975, there was a big downpour and it washed away a lot of the land, and that's when the very first ruins were uncovered. And once archaeologists came in, boy, they were amazed, because not only do you have the oldest cemetery for ancient island people with what at least 186 complete skeletons, but again, they determined this was the oldest astronomical observatory.
Huh.
Of course, I wanted to get to the bottom of, like, what does that mean? You know, what did they find exactly? So I went there to check it out, and boy, did I hit the jackpot. I was able to be shown around by one of the chief researchers there who had been there for decades. I was given behind-the-scenes VIP access to even see stuff that was behind the scenes that had not even been categorized. And ultimately, for one thing, if you go to the Coast to Coast AM website and you look at the pictures, you'll see that some of these little artifacts that they have pulled from the ground there look very much like extraterrestrials. As a matter of fact, one of them, George, even looks almost exactly like E.T. from Steven Spielberg's movie. Also, of course, the people there were into cranial deformation, elongating the skulls, which has always been really weird to me. Now, we're talking about a site that has been active for at least 2,000 years or more, around the time of Christ. And now, when you go there and you look around, you see all these weird stone structures. You've got some of the usual stuff, like the batets, like the ball courts and all that, but you have these other very weird sort of, you know, alignments of stones. And the scientists there told me, we have no doubt this is an observatory because of the alignment, which not only aligns with certain celestial bodies, but he said that it has its own internal alignment. And I said, what kind of alignment are we talking about? So we went around with a compass, and we started taking pictures, and it turns out that the entire thing is aligned to be shifted from the northeast to the southwest. Now, that's kind of curious, because here in Puerto Rico, you see beautiful sunsets, you see beautiful sunrises. Why wouldn't it just be aligned east to west? Why northeast to southwest? Well, it turns out that all these years I've been coming here doing research, over 10 years, 90% of the time when somebody tells me they have seen a UFO flying through the sky, it is on that pathway from the southwest to the northeast or vice versa. And, of course, when you take that alignment into consideration and you see that we have this at the ancient site, well, then you think, well, maybe this is telling us something about this ancient highway that E.T. or other, you know, strange things have traveled. And by the way, if you extend that line all the way southwest, you hit the old ancient Mayan territory. Okay, you hit that area that goes from Belize down to Costa Rica. And, of course, they talked about all kinds of beings in the sky, Kukulkan, Quetzalcoatl, et cetera. And even some of the natives here at this site, which is called the Tibas Indigenous Ceremonial Center, they have evidence that the natives there would sit around and they would snort this powder called cahoba up their nose, and they would have these hallucinogenic experiences, and they did that in order to try to facilitate communication with flying gods, right?
They did a lot of mind-altering things in those days, didn't they?
Well, they certainly did. And we always have this question, George, you know, were people doing that to create this kind of universal experience that just happens to show people these alien beings that come from the sky? Or is this stimulating and opening a part of the brain that gives you greater perception of these things? But, you know, this alignment is a very important factor in why I chose the place I chose to put this webcam. But to further demonstrate and further illustrate just how prominent some of this UFO activity seems to be on this side of the island, we'll move on to Chapter 2 and something that I think is absolutely astounding, especially if you know what you're looking at. You see, a couple years ago, many of the residents here in Puerto Rico on this side of the island who have gotten to know me, trust me, feel comfortable talking to me, started coming to me very excitedly saying, man, listen, my brother or my neighbor or whoever, it depended on the person, of course, works at the Homeland Security Office in Aguadilla, and they captured a UFO that's going to blow your mind. Now, before I continue, let me explain. Aguadilla is a point on the it's in the top northwestern corner of the island of Puerto Rico. And there is a commercial airport there called the Rafael Hernandez Airport. I've flown in and out many, many times. And there is also a Homeland Security station there. Well, I kept hearing these stories. I said, I want to see this footage. And, of course, everybody was like, well, this is top secret. We're not even supposed to talk about this. And I just bided my time, and eventually, sure enough, this footage was leaked onto the internet. And when you watch this footage and you know what you're looking at, it is absolutely incredible. Before I start describing it, let me just tell everybody, if you go to my website, joshuapwarren.com, there is no period after the P, joshuapwarren.com, scroll down the homepage, you'll see this footage. It's almost 4 minutes long, as well as enhancements that I have done of different parts of the footage.
And not doctored, but enhanced.
That's correct. I did not change anything other than simply taking the detail that was there and bringing it out and enhancing it through contrast and sharpness. And if you click any of these enhancements, it blows it up into a larger still that you can look at. So here's what happened. On April the 25th of 2013, around 9:20 p.m. local time, residents around Aguadilla started seeing what they described as a pinkish to reddish light flying around the area. And now this is something that I'd heard from residents around there for at least 6 months prior. People were seeing this reddish light. One guy even went out one night with his iPhone and captured pictures and video footage of this light. Now that night, April 25th, 2013, the weather was nice. It was about 79 degrees. There were scattered clouds, but it was very mild. Well, right there at that Homeland Security and Customs area, that station, they have an aircraft that flies around. It is called a DHC-8 turboprop, operated by the Homeland Security, Customs, and Border Protection. And they filmed this object. Now, for one thing, when this thing was actually seen, they had to delay the departure of a commercial aircraft because this object was not communicating with the tower. It didn't have any squawking transponder signal or anything like that to alert the tower. And you're watching this footage through an infrared/thermal camera. And what you see is this dark object that is zipping around at incredible speeds. It almost has a shape-shifting appearance, and fortunately, this footage was taken by a group of mainstream scientists in the U.S. calling themselves the Scientific Coalition for Ufology, and they put together a 162-page report analyzing this. It's a fantastic report. There's a link to it there on my website next to the video. And what they determined is that as you watch this object, it's about 3 to 5 feet in length. It's traveling up to 120 miles per hour. And as it's zipping around, showing blatant disregard for any kind of security around the airport, this object actually goes out and dips into the Atlantic Ocean. when it slips into the ocean, you can still see it moving below the surface at 95 miles per hour through the water. It looks like it dips in and out of the water a few times. When it emerges from the water, it is now joined by a second UFO. And this has been certainly ruled out as a shadow or any kind of an optical illusion. Now these two objects are continuing to zip around, showing astounding speed and maneuverability.
And do they show any aggression at all?
No aggression whatsoever. In fact, they seem to be completely uninterested in the fact that they're being observed or that there's an airplane right there on the runway. You can see an airplane at one point literally below. And now when you're looking at this thing through thermal, keep in mind black means it's hotter and white means it's cooler. So they're estimating the exterior of this thing, which looks a little lighter, is around 70 degrees. Right in the middle is certainly, they can tell, over 105 degrees, but we're not sure how much hotter. Now, there is nothing about this object that leads you to believe it is aerodynamically sound. It doesn't have wings. It doesn't have a rotor. It is absolutely not like any kind of drone that we know of.
It's anti-gravity. It's got to be, Josh.
Well, it seems to be able to travel so easily through the elements, just slipping from the air into the water. And, I mean, to watch this thing travel below the surface of the water is even more incredible. What is the power supply for this thing? What, I mean, can you imagine if we could figure out how to take an object that is, again, 3 or 5 feet in length and make it create these maneuvers?
Oh, wow.
And then finally, at the end of the video, this object goes out and appears to dip one final time into the Atlantic Ocean. At that point, the camera from Homeland Security continues to move back and forth searching for it. They don't see it again. But mind you, George, this whole thing, culminating in the moment when this object goes under the water, is very close to the Puerto Rico Trench, which is the second deepest point in the world. It is the deepest point in the Atlantic Ocean. It's 28,373 deep.
28,000. Wow. And the Mariana Trench is the biggest, of course, deepest.
That's the biggest.
Yeah.
And this one at over 28,000 feet deep is so deep you could almost take Mount Everest and put it down there in this trench, and the water would almost cover the top of Mount Everest. So all this is taking place near this incredibly deep trench, and we can imagine that when this thing finally goes under the water, it's going down to some kind of underground base.
Wow.
And so what we have here is a UFO turning into a USO, and actually going back and forth a number of times.
Captured by Homeland Security video.
Yeah, what is a more credible source than that? I mean, and the technology is there. With we know that some of the details about the thermal imaging that was used, and this is something that defies even what we thought was weird. We knew that UFOs were weird. You watch this, this is even weirder because, again, this thing does not keep one kind of fixed shape. It seems to be able to morph. And when I watch this thing, I wonder, are we looking at UFOs that are literally some kind of craft, or is this a living organism of some kind, or when technology advances enough, do the two merge indistinguishably? And we have actually a UFO, a technology, and a consciousness all together in this very bizarre-looking thing.
More to come with Joshua P. Warren and an hour of your phone calls. Anything paranormal that you want to ask Josh, do so when we come right back.